Okay, so now I'll turn it over to Satyadev Prabhu. He can give us his. Can sit over here. Can give us your latest realizations and give us a little nectar. What you've been thinking about, meditating on, speaking about. You want to sit in a chair down? Move that over here. I'll just move over here. It'll be better. You want that or you want this? Chair, okay?
No, I'll sit in the chair.
Good. Take the chair. I'll take your seat.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'm so happy to be back. This is my home. Japan was it was exciting this time. It felt shorter because I went there with Vaisheshika Prabhu, and for the first week we went down to Osaka, and he initiated Vansha Atitya, who is a longtime friend of mine, and Vaish, we've known him for over 20 years, and he'd waited all this time to take initiation, and he became convinced that Vaisheshika Prabhu was his guru a couple of years ago in Vrindavan, and so he'd been waiting patiently all this time, and so he took initiation, and it was a wonderful ceremony. And many devotees in Japan came there to join in. And we were both thinking it was, after the initiation, it was one of the most ecstatic kirtans we'd been in. And so that was the beginning of our trip together. We traveled for 2 weeks. But just the mood of that kirtan and the happiness of the devotees just kind of, we carried it with us wherever wherever we went. And then we went to Tokyo, and then we went to China for, I think, 10 days. And that was my first time to China. We went to Taiwan and saw the devotees there. And it reminded me a little bit of Japan, because there's not a lot of devotees, but the devotees there are very sincere, and they're plugging along. The only difference is they have quite a few of Srila Prabhupada's books translated and published all the way up to the ninth canto. And in Japan, we don't even have the first canto completely. We have only up to the first eight chapters of the first canto in Bhagavad Gita. So I was a little envious about that, but very respectful. And we went out in Harinam. Vaish gave book distribution seminars in Taipei. Taipei is like the capital city. And then we went to the middle city called Taichung. And there, it wasn't a temple, it was a yoga center. And the people that were coming there were not actually all devotees. There were about 20 people there. And I would say maybe half of them were devotees and half of them weren't. But Vaisheshika Prabhu, being the optimistic, unstoppable Sankirtan leader that he is, he gave this book distribution seminar to these people basically who were not devotees, and they all went out on Sankirtan, and they all went out on book distribution, and they all loved it. And they all had a very positive experience. And I did too. And even though I didn't speak any Chinese, somehow we all got by, and it was very enlivening. So Taiwan was, you know, is a free country. There's freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, all the things we take for granted. And then we went from that experience, and we went to the mainland China, which was my first time, and we went to Chengdu, which is on the border of Tibet. And it's a big city in China. And actually, Tibet is quite a large country when you look at it, but it's all mountains. So I didn't. Chengdu is famous because it's always covered by clouds. So we could really never see if there were mountains around or not. It was that cloudy. It wasn't real cold, and it wasn't real rainy, just kind of drizzly and cloudy. But it's what shocked me most or impressed me the most was how wealthy it is, how much money is there flowing from America to China. Everything was under construction. Everything was new. And we stayed in a hotel, our Chinese devotee, Shakshi Gopal, he was our host. And he works for the government as kind of an internet monitor, if you can imagine that. And he would come and bring us prasadam in our hotel room, and then we were to go to different engagements at yoga centers, which are not religious, you know, they're for relaxation and whatnot. And there are a lot of devotees in China, and they become devotees over the internet and over these yoga centers, but everyone just wears pink clothes. You can't wear, you can't go chanting, you can't go outside and go for a japa walk and have your bead bag dangling, or you can't assemble in somebody's apartment with unknown people going there. So somehow or other, the government found out that we were going to go to this yoga center and have a program that night. And they called Shakshi and said, you know, you don't have a permit for this. And so we hemmed and hawed about what to do. Should we go do the engagement or should we not? And ultimately it was decided that the Chinese devotee, the translator from Taiwan, who's been doing programs in China, her and her husband were going to go. Her husband is a French devotee who speaks perfect Mandarin, amazing duo. And they went and we didn't go. Because if the government would have come there, they could have busted us and deported us from the country, and we never would have been able to go back. And so anyway, it turns out nobody came, and we probably could have went. But it was a shocker for me to realize that, you know, this is a country where you don't have freedom of religion, you don't have freedom of assembly, and you don't have freedom of speech. I'd never really been in that situation before, so it really made me appreciate more the opportunities we have here in America and Japan and Taiwan. I mean, we're free to preach to our heart's content, practically in any way we want to. I mean, within the law, but I mean, especially in America, there's quite a latitude there. So that was a very interesting experience. And then to meet the Chinese devotees, we ended up meeting at a restaurant that is run by Master Ching Hai. She has a number of vegetarian restaurants here in San Jose and San Francisco. So they're very favorable to us. So we had a program in their restaurant, and probably 30, 40 Chinese devotees came. The oldest was 76 years old, this amazing, bright-eyed, very enthusiastic Chinese man who, I think he got Bhagavad Gita through someone and immediately just became a devotee by it. So we took over the restaurant, had kirtan there and talks and for about 3 or 4 hours. And then, so that was the highlight of our program. And then the Chinese devotees, they're so much starving for association and to learn from other devotees because they're so oppressed. That I was really taken by that. So I started giving a Monday morning class to them. And Shakshi Gopal, the internet monitor, he's arranging for this Skype class with a translator in one location. He's in another location. And at one point, there were 50 people listening. So regularly, there's been 20, 25 people listening. So I did that from the time we left China, and I did it actually. I did the first class Monday. I'm going to try and continue it from America just once a week, 1 hour class. And So now a Monday here will be a Tuesday morning there. They listen to the class from 7 in the morning till 8, and then they go to work. And so by Skype, all these people who are not supposed to be listening to the class are listening to the class, and it's exciting, you know. And also, they're so appreciative. So that was a real one of the highlights of my trip this time, was just to make that connection with those devotees and see that devotees are the same everywhere, no matter what their age is or what their culture is. Once they have appreciation for Srila Prabhupada and his books and for Krishna, it's the same devotion, you know, and the same knowledge is there, and the same process of from Shraddha, you know, through Anartha Nirviti. And so then in Japan, we continued having Skype classes, but in Japan we had it a morning Srimad Bhagavatam class every morning at 6:30. And devotees were listening in Tokyo, who live far away from the temple. And they were translated from England. Our audience was basically Chinese, Russian, Japanese, and Indians, so English speakers. And so we had always a mix. And we had a routinely 10 to 15 listeners every morning at 6:30. So Maru Mangal, the temple president, would translate the classes from English into Japanese. And then sometimes there were Russian devotees in the class who spoke Japanese but didn't speak English, or who spoke English but didn't speak Japanese, and on some occasions who only spoke Russian. And so there was sometimes there were translators for them too. And there was devotees listening from Osaka, and even one devotee listening from New Zealand, a Japanese devotee there. So Skype has become real useful, and we really took advantage of it this time. And we could have been taking advantage, you know, of it before, but this, it really helped bring the devotees together. And really, because of this consistent hearing and chanting, even from a distance, devotees felt connected and continued to hear the vibration, the transcendental vibration, to stay inspired, you know, in spiritual life. And so the devotee association is so essential, and we kind of take it for granted here because everyone lives close by, and we, you know, everyone speaks English, so we have full access to Srila Prabhupada's books. And different devotees come through here because they all want to associate with you and Vaisheshika Prabhu. So we actually have so much here at ISV that a lot of other devotees don't have. And so those were the highlights of my trip. We're also in the process of getting a new temple in Tokyo, and there's a lot of endeavor for that. And it looks like it's going to happen. We'll know for sure at the end of August. And so that's much needed. The temple right now has been in the same place for about 15 years, and it's one of the first high-rise apartment buildings in Tokyo. Tokyo has lots of earthquakes, and they never used to build high-rise buildings there because of that. And so this particular high-rise was probably built 40 or 50 years ago. And because it's so old, the landlord does nothing to maintain it. So it's totally fallen apart. And as far as building codes go, if there's a big earthquake, Hare Krishna. There's seven floors above the temple. And the temple, it's kind of low and very dark. And so when people come there, their first impression, especially Japanese, they're very sensitive, and they're very much influenced by first impressions. The Indian devotees who come, you know, as soon as they see the deities, they just forget about whatever external environment's there. But the Japanese, as soon as they see where the temple is, they're afraid to just go down to go into it, you know. So it's really kind of held us back. So I'm glad that we're finally going to be getting out of there, and I think this will actually help us expand in a much bigger way than we've been able to. And it's bringing a lot of devotees together. I wasn't so much, haven't been involved in working on the project, but it's nice to see a lot of devotees stepping forward to get a new place, and everyone wants to cooperate and work together. And so as far as what I've been, my realizations and reading and chanting, well, we were reading the story of Dhruva Maharaj. It's a long chapter, that first chapter called Dhruva Maharaj Leaves Home. I think there's like 80 verses in the chapter, and we got up to about verse 70 during that time. And God, there's so many interesting instructions by Narada Muni to Dhruva Maharaj. Our whole process of devotional service through all the stages is there. And deity worship and initiation and Narada Muni's first two instructions to Dhruva Maharaj were so profound. I mentioned one of them tonight. I didn't mention the whole verse, though. Actually, Dhruva Maharaj, the first thing Narada Muni said to Dhruva Maharaj was, in all circumstances, you should cultivate satisfaction. In spite of your happiness and distress, which you should accept as the will of the Lord. And he said, if you do this, you will easily overcome the darkness of material life and attain liberation. That was the first instruction. And so how do you cultivate, you know, satisfaction when you're experiencing distress, you know, happiness and distress, you know, or attachment and aversion? But that means, you know, becoming Brahman realized, becoming introspective, and, you know, taking 100% responsibility, you know, for your feelings. And Krishna says, you know, cultivating satisfaction is an austerity of the mind. So it can be done, and it is a particular practice. But it's a very mode of goodness practice. And Dhruva Maharaj ultimately said, it's very nice, this instruction of yours, but it doesn't touch my heart. And then the second instruction was, and I really was meditating on this one a lot, because devotees in Japan and everywhere, sometimes they have difficulties getting along. And there's, you know, false egos erupt, and people want to be right. People, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. These kind of arguments going on. And so I thought this instruction was perfect for this. Narada Muni said, and this is his second instruction to Dhruva Maharaj, he said, I've given you the key of how to cross over the ocean of ignorance. Now I'll give you the key of, while you're crossing over, how to be happy while you're crossing over. So then he said, if you meet somebody who's more qualified than you, become very happy. Very similar to the instruction in Nectar of Instruction, where if you meet a very, very advanced devotee, you should work hard and serve them. Of course, when we meet somebody that's more qualified than us, and I was thinking, you know, the very day, well, I'll tell you, he said, if you meet somebody who's more qualified than you, become very happy. If you meet somebody who is equal to you, establish a friendship with that person. And if you meet somebody who's less qualified than you, at least in your mind, you're thinking, you know, this person doesn't have it together, or they have this fault and that fault, then you should be very compassionate to that person, and you should try and help them out. And of course, I'll just speak for myself. Generally, if I meet somebody who's more qualified than us, I become afraid, and I become insecure, and as a result, I spend a lot of time trying to show that person how, you know, how good I am. And if I meet somebody who's equal to me, similar reaction, but more like that, I see that person as a legitimate competitor rather than a friend. And if I see somebody who's less qualified than me, then I start seeing all the faults they have. Yeah, this is wrong, that's wrong, you know. why isn't he steady? You know, why is he still taking drugs? And, you know, on and on and on. And all the time feeling so good. Oh, I'm, you know. So it's just like some people that are overweight, if they see somebody who's more overweight, then they makes them feel happy, right? Anyway, just the opposite of Narada Muni's instruction. And so you can see that if one actually, you know, cultivates this quality of actually being happy and taking shelter of somebody who's more advanced and actually becoming friendly and revealing one's heart and developing a friendly relationship with somebody who is equal and being compassionate and helpful to those who need help, then actually one will be very happy in this world, because most of our stress, most of our anxiety is in three categories. Either it has to do with our health, or it has to do with our money, or it has to do with our relationships. And I think mostly it's our relationships. And we encounter difficulty and unhappiness because of, you know, ultimately this comes back to the false ego. So a lot of the classes that we were talking about were about what is the false ego. You know, why is it afraid? It's not the soul, actually. We say, I'm afraid. It's actually not the soul that's afraid, but it's the false ego. It's the imaginary self that's afraid and that feels that it has to prove itself to somebody who's so-called, you know, more superior. As we advance in spiritual life and see that we're not the false ego, that we're the spirit soul, then there's no more competition, there's no more higher and lower, and there's no more of this anxiety or fear. Ultimately, it's fear, fear of death. You know, the false ego is afraid of dying, and the bodily cells actually have that memory imprinted in them as well, so it becomes like a physical response as well, not just a mental response. But, you know, having somebody like Narada Muni point these things out so that we can become aware of them, then we can begin to see the demon, you know, within us. And, you know, if we don't see the demon and we're in denial, then there's no chance for any kind of solution. But when we actually see the demon, and then if we take a few steps of, you know, practice some self-inquiry and analyze what that demon is and really start to look at him, because the demon really is just a collection of memories in the mind that can't stand in the light of awareness. It begins to disappear. But that's a practice. And Narada Muni was recommending that practice to Dhruva Maharaj, but Dhruva Maharaj, he said, look, you know, I have strong material desires. I want a kingdom that's greater than my grandfather's. And his grandfather is Lord Brahma. So Lord Brahma is the creator of the universe. He says, I want a position greater than him. And so when I, you know, when we look at our own material desires, that's pretty puny compared to Dhruva Maharaj. So he said, you know, I have this kind of material desire. And besides that, I'm super angry, you know. The words of my stepmother pierced my heart, and I'm suffering this pain. So although, Narada Muni, I really appreciate your instructions, and I don't mean to be disrespectful or unsubmissive, but I'm just being honest with you. I cannot, your instructions just do not touch my heart. And therefore, then he said, please give me a process that I can honestly follow. And so we began to talk about this a lot too, that how important it is to actually be honest, to be real, and then to approach your spiritual master, just like Narada Muni, like Dhruva Maharaj, has done and said, look, you know, I really can't do this. Please give me something that I can honestly do to make progress, you know. I can't start from up here. I really am down here. I need to start down here. So he wasn't saying that I'm giving up, that I can't do it, but he's saying, you know, you're my spiritual master, you're the doctor, please, you know, diagnose my disease and give me a medicine that, you know, that I can take. So that was pretty much, you know, what we were discussing during the classes, and it came into real life. You know, there were devotees getting divorced and who needed counseling, and devotees about to get divorced who needed counseling or didn't get divorced, and then, you know, suffering the traumas, suffering the griefs that come to us in life. No matter what stage we're in, we have different problems and we need support. And when we have support and we support each other, we can move through them. And without that support, it's very, very difficult. And without a safe environment where we can be honest, then we can't really seek the support of others. So having a safe environment is first. Even before you can be honest, you need, you know, the hierarchy of needs. You need to have that safe place. ISB is that safe place for me and the association of devotees that I have here. Because safety means trust, based on trust. And over time, the trust develops. And you see that this person loves me. They're not going to hurt me. And that if I reveal to them my problems, then they're really going to try and help me. And then, but that doesn't happen suddenly. But over time, devotees who support each other, they develop this trust, and that's the bottom line in relationships and having a community. So, we're working on it there. And there's ups and there's downs, but you know, there's nowhere else to go. We're in this material world together, and we're all trying to go back to Godhead. So. We are lucky if we have this shelter. Yeah.
Regarding these instructions that Narad Muni was giving, like the second instruction, the person you meet more qualified than you, equally qualified or less qualified, was he referring to devotees or everyone? Whether the person is a devotee or non-devotee, you would still treat them that way.
He didn't make distinction. Because in our life, we're going to encounter many different types of people, whether they're devotees or non-devotees. Our response is really going to determine, is going to be determined by our level of awareness, not really by if the person's a devotee or not. This is my understanding. And that whatever our response is has nothing to do with that person. It's totally our baggage, you know, and our responsibility. And the results will be determined by what our response is, not by the other person, really.
And the first instruction, which was... become satisfied or get satisfaction. What kind of satisfaction was he referring to? Is this some be content with what you have or what you do, or is it seeking some mental satisfaction or satisfaction through devotional service? Mm. What kind of satisfaction was he referring to?
Of course, he didn't specify. So I took it as Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, or I can't get no satisfaction. So the consciousness or the living being is by nature self-satisfied, Brahma Bhuta. Krishna also says, Prajahati yada kaman sarvan partha manogatan atma. He says that sense desires arise out of mental concoction. One who's in transcendental consciousness becomes satisfied in the self alone. And so if we are always trying to adjust our happiness and distress, which is coming to us by the will of the Lord, which is really out of our control, if we're resisting that, then we stay in the state of identification with the mind and the body, and we suffer. But if we do not resist the happiness and the stress and we accept it and we stay fixed on the, with our attention fixed within the Atma, which is always present in the moment, and in the moment, really, there is no problem. You know, the consciousness is always there, and it's always satisfied within. And if we learn how to be in touch with that, and that's where our focus is, basically, if we're feeling our life as opposed to always thinking about it, which means thinking about the past or the future, then we'll experience satisfaction in spite of the happiness and distress that's coming to us, and we'll feel our connection with the Lord, who's the source of our life. And in that way, that's a certain practice that as devotees, you know, we're supposed to be practicing.
So in that respect, we could say that that instruction he was giving is similar to what Krishna is telling Arjuna to become situated in the self. He mentions a couple of places.
And actually, and the nuance of the instruction is Narada Muni saying that you should accept the will of the Lord. So this is actually an instruction for surrender. So it means when we're resisting what we're getting, in a sense, we're not surrendered to Krishna. And we're trying on our own to find satisfaction and happiness separate from the Atma, separate from Krishna. And therefore, that's the source of our suffering. It's not the so-called external cause. So really, Narada Muni is telling Dhruva Maharaj, if you want to make rapid spiritual advancement and cross over this ocean of ignorance very easily, then surrender to the will of the Lord and remain satisfied within. But Dhruva Maharaj says, you know, sounds nice, but I can't do that. Thank you.
Babaji, can I ask a question first?
Yes.
In China, you said there's no religious freedom, so there are no temples or churches or mosques, nothing like that? Or, I mean, it was a Buddhist country, so what happened to all those things?
No, there is religion. There are certain temples, and maybe even the Catholic Church, but they're strictly controlled by the state. And you can assemble, but you have to have a permit. And if the government doesn't give you a permit, then you can't assemble. And if you do it without a permit, then... So it's strictly controlled, and there is religion. There are monks in certain temples, but you know, they can only read certain things, and their what they're teaching and their assembly is strictly monitored and controlled by the government. And especially like new religions or minority, not new, but minority religions, they can't get a permit, even if you apply for one. So you have to do it in an undercover way. So every time you go out to Walmart, you know, say an extra Hari Bol. or to Palo Alto or wherever we go out, you know, into the public, or even just to assemble here. We never have to think about the government, what the government's going to do or what the neighbors are going to say. If your neighbor reports you to the government, you know, comes and checks you out. The allegation may not even be real. So that's the kind of atmosphere that they're living under. So, Ijo. Okay. Hare Krishna.